what they're seeing, that might help to sort of deduce something that's a joke from something that might be real.
The claims on social media appear to have come from a satirical account, although others believed animals really were leaving the park in droves. Poland wrote an article for the Yellowstone Caldera Chronicles to dispel these rumors. The Chronicles consist of weekly columns written by scientists and collaborators at the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Poland says internet hoaxes like this one happen from time to time and are usually pretty harmless. However, the rumors did have an impact on the staff at Yellowstone National Park.
It hit the national park hard in that they got all kinds of inquiries. So they spent a bunch of their time trying to respond to those inquiries rather than doing other things that might be more constructive.
While fears have persisted that the caldera under Yellowstone will erupt, Poland says that isn't likely.
Reality is that the Yellowstone magma body is mostly solid. We're just not worried about a volcanic eruption there. On human timescales, the bigger hazards are a strong tectonic earthquake, something like the magnitude 7.3 that happened in 1959, a steam explosion like the one that happened just last year.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 7th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Hannah Francis, and Eric Tegedoff. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Glad to have you here. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. And if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Trump's tariff war moves into high gear. Putin's playing of Trump continues. And no peace in Gaza. First, Trump's tariff war moves into high gear. Trump's August 1 deadline for trade agreements has come and gone, still with no agreements finalized with the top 15 U.S. trade partners. Preliminary deals have been made with 9 of the top 15. 2 other deals are in negotiations, China and Mexico. And 4 countries, including India and Canada, have been targeted by Trump with high tariffs, not just for lack of an agreement, but because of their resistance to Trump's political demands. Let's take a closer look at these deals. China-U.S. trade talks in Stockholm were expected to lead to an agreement that would extend the current tariffs beyond the August 12 deadline. No agreement was reached. If the deadline passes, the U.S. will reimpose tariffs that could come to anywhere between 30 and 145%. Mexico was granted a 90-day extension on trade talks, meaning a 25% tariff rate remains in effect instead of the threatened 30%. As for the preliminary deals, Japan worked Trump down to 15%, based partly on a $550 billion commitment he claims Japan made to invest in the U.S. South Korea agreed to a 15% tariff rate and $350 billion worth of investments in the U.S. But Trump's claim that U.S. beef and rice will have greater access to the Korean market, a concession that has Korean farmers up in arms, was contradicted by Seoul. Note that the terms of these deals are fuzzy, with different expectations on each side. The European Union's agreed-upon rate was also 15%, up from 1.2%. The EU also promised major new investments and purchases of U.S. goods and agreed to no tariff on U.S. exports to the EU. Most observers said the EU leadership decided that a bad deal was better than a trade war, and it is largely a bad deal, especially for German auto exports and French agricultural exports to the U.S. Here again, however, These investment promises may be just hype. Whether or not they will happen is unpredictable and will not be clarified for years to come. Next, the targeted countries. U.S.-India relations are not going well as Trump imposed a 25% tariff plus a penalty tariff if India did not stop buying Russian oil and military goods. Note that Trump has not imposed a penalty or tariff on Russia. Trump said the trade deficit with India was too high. This is a blow to the supposedly tight friendship between Trump and India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Then there's Canada and another example of injecting politics into trade deals. Wow, said Trump. Canada has just announced that it is backing statehood for Palestine. That will make it very hard for us to make a trade deal with them, he said. Canada is now subject to a 35% tariff on all goods not covered by the U.S.-Canada-Mexico trade agreement. Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney responded to Trump's tariff by stressing Canadian self-reliance. Quote, Canada will be our own best customer, creating more well-paying careers at home as we strengthen and diversify our trading partnerships throughout the world. Beyond the top 15 trade partners, one other ongoing case is Brazil, where Trump carried through on his threat to impose a 50% tariff on Brazilian imports in a clumsy attempt to get a reprieve for his far-right buddy and coup conspirator, the former President Jair Bolsonaro, who is under house arrest awaiting trial. Brazil did not budge from opposing this intervention in its politics, and its stubbornness paid off as Trump exempted key Brazilian exports, such as civilian aircraft and orange juice, from the high tariff rate. Several important outcomes of the tariff war need to be clarified. First is the legality of Trump's tariffs. A U.S. Court of Appeals heard arguments on Trump's reliance on emergency economic powers to impose tariffs. No doubt the Supreme Court will take on this matter. Second is the impact of the tariffs on the U.S. economy. While the stock market and corporate profits are up, consumer spending is down, inflation is up, and the job market is far down, which is why Trump had to fire the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Corporate layoffs are the highest in 5 years, and 113,000 manufacturing jobs have been lost over the past year. It's bewildering to me that liberal media such as the Washington Post are proclaiming Trump's tariffs a win for the administration. Third point, it is likely that economic news will get worse. That's because, as a writer for The Atlantic explains, quote, many companies did in fact stock up on imported goods before the tariffs kicked in. Others have been eating the cost of the tariffs to avoid raising prices in the hopes that the duties would go away. Now that tariffs seem to be here to stay, more and more companies will likely be forced to either raise prices or slash their costs, including labor costs. A return to the 1970s-style combination of rising inflation and unemployment is looking a lot more likely, unquote. That, folks, is called stagflation. Putin's playing of Trump continues. President Trump gave Vladimir Putin 50 days to reach a ceasefire agreement with Ukraine or face U.S. sanctions. Some people actually believed either that Putin would rush to the negotiating table or that Trump would impose sanctions on Russia if it did not. Late last month, following a third round of talks, Russia's representative put the kibosh on Putin's taking part in peace talks, saying the two sides had diametrically opposed peace plans, which is true, and therefore that there would be no Putin-Zelensky meeting to sign off on an agreement. Zelensky reiterated his view that only a face-to-face meeting with Putin can resolve differences. In the face of Russian intransigence, will Trump follow through on his threat of sanctions? All he has said is gobbledygook. At one point he said, it's going to happen, a Putin-Zelensky meeting, but it should have happened 3 months ago. It's going to happen. It could be that we'll have to put secondary sanctions on Russia. Maybe, he said, sooner than his 50-day deadline. While golfing in Scotland, Trump said he was disappointed with Russia and might impose sanctions in 10 to 12 days. Russia's former president, Dmitry Medvedev, introduced a volatile new element in the dispute by reminding the U.S. that Russia has formidable nuclear weapon capabilities. Trump took the bait and ordered two nuclear submarines to be deployed, quote, in the appropriate regions, in response to Medvedev's, quote, foolish and inflammatory statements. Then Trump went off to his golf club, and Russia continued bombing Kyiv. A UN human rights group in Ukraine reports that Russia launched 10 times as many attacks on Ukraine in July as it did in June, with the highest number of civilians killed and injured in 3 years. And still, no sanctions on Russia. no peace in Gaza. As I reported in my Tuesday commentary, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his far-right supporters are brazenly violating the Genocide Convention by starving the Palestinian population in the Gaza Strip and by moving ahead with plans to annex Gaza and the West Bank, forcibly removing their populations. No doubt the far right has been emboldened by the U.S. decision to withdraw from peace talks with Hamas. Steve Witkoff, Trump's envoy to the talks, said Hamas's leadership showed, quote, a lack of desire to reach a ceasefire in Gaza. How strange that he did not mention the Netanyahu government's lack of desire, amply demonstrated not just by the starvation and deportation policies, but also by its insistence that Hamas lay down its arms and its rejection of a permanent ceasefire. And Netanyahu has just said that Israel intends to occupy Gaza. Trump's optimism about peace being at hand has shown him out of touch with actual conditions. Trump did profess concern about starvation conditions in Gaza, telling Israel to allow every ounce of food, quote-unquote, into Gaza. But will Trump do anything when Netanyahu continues to sharply limit food aid in Gaza? Will Trump oppose Israel's annexation of occupied land? Will he deprive Israel of weapons? The answer is almost no to every one of those. France's President Emmanuel Macron has announced that France will recognize a Palestinian state when the UN General Assembly convenes in the fall. The United Kingdom announced it will do the same, provided Israel does not agree to a ceasefire in Gaza. Canada added to the list. The three countries join around 140 other countries that have done so, but not the U.S., which instead has announced that it will deny visas to Palestine Liberation Organization and Palestinian Authority officials. Nothing like punishing the victim. Still, when all is said and done, one has to ask whether recognition of Palestinian statehood, while a noble act, will do anything to prevent the ongoing carnage in Gaza. In other news, Thailand and Cambodia agree to a ceasefire in their border dispute. After several days of trading fire, Thailand and Cambodia agreed to an unconditional ceasefire and talks between regional military commanders. Thai and Cambodian forces had both reported casualties in a resumption of their long-running dispute over a border that is over 800 kilometers long. The Thai Air Force had reportedly struck military targets in Cambodia. As I've reported previously, this dispute began when Thailand's Prime Minister Prithongthon Chinawatra was accused of betraying the nation by cozying up to Cambodia's one-time strongman, Hun Sen, the father of the current Prime Minister. The Thai Prime Minister was suspended from office on July 1. An acting Prime Minister attended the ceasefire announcement, which took place in Malaysia. Although Malaysia and China played key roles in the ceasefire agreement, Donald Trump took all the credit for it. On his badly named Truth Social, he wrote, quote, by ending this war, we have saved thousands of lives. I have instructed my trade team to restart negotiations on trade. I have now ended many wars in just 6 months. I am proud to be the president of peace. The man's ego is boundless. He hasn't ended any wars. Actually, Trump is being criticized in Southeast Asia for using the threat of high tariffs to pressure Thailand and Cambodia to settle their differences. Indirect coercion is how one Thai legislator characterized Trump's peace initiative. North Korea rejects South Korea's peace overtures. South Korea's new president has been focused on domestic affairs and only to a small extent on North Korea. Lee Jae-myung did take one small step to ease tensions with the North. He suspended loudspeaker broadcasts blasting anti-North propaganda across the border, and he banned the flying of leaflets by activists that had angered Pyongyang. But Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un's powerful sister, Kim Yo-jong, said those moves are merely a reversal of ill-intentioned activities by South Korea that should never have been made in the first place. In other words, she said, it's not even something worth our assessment. We again make clear the official position that whatever policy is established in Seoul or proposal is made, we are not interested and we will not be sitting down with South Korea and there is nothing to discuss, unquote. South Korea's National Intelligence Service is said to believe that the North now has a sense of confidence that it finds itself in a much more favorable strategic environment. That is said to be because its nuclear capabilities have expanded, it has backing from Russia through its dispatch of troops to the Ukraine war, and North Korea has become the largest arms supplier to Russia in the war. Consequently, Seoul's National Intelligence Service reports, Kim Jong-un is not in a rush either to meet with South Korea's new president or resume talks with the United States, and in neither case with denuclearization on the agenda. Finally, a former international crimes prosecutor warns of executions in Iran. Stephen J. Rapp has issued a warning to the international community about rising executions of dissenters in Iran. He was chief of prosecutions at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda and the prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. Executions, not gunfire, says Rapp, have become the regime's long-term weapon of repression. In 2023, more than 850 people were put to death. In 2024, the number approached 1,000. This year, a UN special rapporteur warned that Iran is set to surpass that figure again. Since the war with Israel, Rapp writes, quote, the regime's response to its perceived vulnerability has become increasingly aggressive. Though its failures might be attributed to incompetence and the foreign penetration of its security services, its fury is being directed at domestic political opponents. Thousands of Iranians are in danger as parliament now seeks to expedite death sentences in cases involving imagined collaboration with foreign entities, unquote. Iran's Revolutionary Guard is reminding people of death commissions that sentenced around 30,000 political prisoners to executions in 1988. Rapp calls on global institutions to act now. He writes, quote, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights should use his authority to launch a fact-finding mission that would signal to the regime that its judicial murders would be exposed to the world, and democratic governments around the world should impose sanctions on perpetrators of Iran's human rights abuses, unquote. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I am David Chittenden. Today, I am joined by Miguel Jeffries, an award-winning Pacific Northwest local filmmaker who is currently working on a new short film called The Tall Gentleman. Hi, Miguel. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Will you give us a short synopsis of the film you're working on?
Yeah, of course. So The Tall Gentleman is a short psychological horror film that's heavily inspired by the online viral legends of the Slender Man. It focuses on the experience of a young man who's, you know, not feeling well and who goes home and starts seeing strange things in the forest around his home and then awakes in the middle of a forest by himself while he's being tormented by the character known as the Tall Gentleman, because we all know we can't actually use the name Slender Man, unfortunately.
Thank you very much, Sony. What is different about the Tall Gentleman versus other slender mythos-based media?
I would definitely say the short film aspect of the film is definitely different than some other more recent projects that have been focused on the Slender Man, including the movie that came out a number of years back. And this one is kind of meant to be more focused on kind of the most memorable aspects of the character. I really wanted to distill down the things that people remember and that are memorable about the Slender Man character and about his mythos, namely, you know, Slender Man being in the woods, including missing children, including Slender Man's servants and the mythos proxies. All of those major things play a role in this short story, and it's supposed to be very pointed and be kind of a fun nostalgia trip, as well as a well-written psychological thriller.
Yeah. The Slender mythos has a pretty semi-substantial cult following. Are you hoping to interact with that, or have you already interacted with that following?
I've attempted to interact with it to the best of my ability. It has been quite a while since the Slender Man has been in the mainstream limelight, but I know there are still people that are big fans of a lot of the Slender Man mythos stories online, and most notably Marble Hornets. People love the Marble Hornets series, and I still see that people are pretty invested in that show, even, you know, just finding out about it years later. I've tried to interact with people online on Facebook, various Facebook fan groups and other social media platforms that are fans of the Slenderman mythos. And it's kind of hard to really connect or really, you know, connect with a fan base that definitely isn't as much in the limelight as it used to be since other horror icons have stepped onto the scene. But I wanted to be able to connect to the best of my ability, so I've gotten some input from the fan base.
All right. Did you know that they're making a part two to Marble Hornets, actually?
They are.
They're making a sequel. It was announced maybe only a month ago.
Really?
Yeah. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but definitely worth looking into. It's the same dude, the same people and everything.
I will definitely. It's so weird that right around this time I'm trying to make a Slenderman movie. I noticed that they, I went to their website because I was going checking it out all the time, doing research for the project, and I noticed that they posted for the first time in a long time. It was something merchandise, mm-hmm. and I was like, oh, that's so weird that now of all times they're posting to their channel, and I didn't know they're making a new one. So that's really exciting.
That was something that I'm glad you brought up, because Marble Hornets, absolute love it. Great Slender Media. What led to having this psychological horror focus in your films?
Well, I'm a huge fan of psychological horror, namely the ability to create unease and thrill and intrigue in people's minds by means that aren't just, you know, in-your-face jump scares, gore, horror, which, you know, there's a time and a place for that. But really, I've seen that the true projects, the true films and art in the horror genre that really stick with people are ones that delve into the psychological themes. That's basically what creepypastas are, I would say. I would argue, at their core is telling a story and painting a picture in somebody's head. There's a lot of great examples of that in modern horror, including the films like Hereditary, and the video game scene. A game I'm a huge fan of is the Doki Doki Literature Club, which is a really good example of psychological horror. Basically using the story, background elements, and all the many things that you have, you know, other than just in-your-face things to kind of give, make people feel deeply unsettled. And that's something that I really strive for in the films that I hope to make, because those are the films that really you remember.
Do you think that this film or the previous films you've done will open up more avenues for the psychological horror genre?
I'm hoping so. Right now is a really good time to be a indie filmmaker, because the YouTube platform, you know, it's as busy as ever, but it comes with a lot of great opportunity. I've watched hundreds of different short films on YouTube from very talented people that, you know, are very talented in their storytelling abilities. And I can't see it, you know, ever shrinking, because there's more and more people on YouTube wanting to tell stories. So hopefully this helps, you know, kind of inspire people and open some avenues for the psychological horror. Because one thing I've really noticed is people, it's really easy to really lean into the more mainstream horror, gore, jump scares, and there's nothing wrong with those things, but I think, you know, writing a story in detail that deeply unsettles people is a little bit more difficult, and which that's, you know, why I have a lot of respect for people that are able to do that.
I would agree. Yeah, I find it takes a certain particular, you need a certain strength knowing how horror works to pull off psychological horror well. Mm-hmm. And I think it really does fall short, especially in mainstream media, with jump scares, with the gore, where it's just let's just give them a small, quick scare instead of leaving them thinking.
Yeah.
Leading into that, why did you start making films?
Well, I've always been interested in the art of filmmaking. Particularly, I've always been a storyteller. I love telling stories. And growing up, I was a really big fan of the filmmaker M. Night Shyamalan. I loved watching his films growing up, particularly the movie Signs. And I was really impressed by the ability to tell a story in a visual manner, you know, because I remember growing up, I had all these stories that I wanted to tell that were on my mind. And me and my family are big fans of kind of the supernatural and, you know, cryptids. And I always imagined having a way to be able to tell those stories in a visceral way. And there's no better way of telling a story than filmmaking. It is really the ultimate form of storytelling.
One of I think John Carpenter is also one of those big names in psychological horror. The Thing alone kind of carried psychological horror because it was like, who is it? Who's doing the stuff? Yeah. Why is they doing it? And like the timeline, the uncertainty, I feel that particularly was a big inspiration for horror as a general. I think like without John Carpenter, horror would not be what it is today.
I would agree with that. Yeah, John Carpenter is a very talented director. It's funny because I just watched The Thing just a couple of weeks ago, and so huge fan of him, especially the Halloween series.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you find the difference to be between short and full-length films, and do you have a preference?
So I'd say just the difference really is the price tag attached to the films. If I had the ability, I would make longer content. It's just, I think everybody kind of understands that filmmaking is an extremely expensive art form, and it's very time consuming and involves a lot of different moving pieces. But short films, you know, to kind of take a particular focus because you have to get your story around very quickly and very effectively. And that's something that I think is that I kind of respect about people that focus in on the filmmaking genre. And it is usually a big stepping stone to, you know, larger projects. And I don't really have a true preference to one or the other. I think both are great depending on the stories that they're telling. And I do aspire to one day make a full-length film project.
What are some of the struggles in filmmaking that you've encountered so far?
I think I kind of alluded to that. filmmaking is very expensive, and so that is a big hurdle. Is just, you know, being able to find people that are interested in the creativity aspect of filmmaking is a wonderful thing because they're interested in telling a story, you know, versus, you know, only how much it's going to cost or what it will benefit them. And you know, there's obviously nothing wrong with thinking about that. But I do have a respect for people that, you know, really want to be storytellers, because it's those kinds of people that create stories that people really want to watch. And so those things, you know, just kind of those two different motivations just kind of fall into place seamlessly if you're focused on the right things. But yeah, they're very difficult to get funding. Equipment costs money. You know, a lot of things cost money. That is a big hurdle. I would say also just communication with people, especially because making a film has lots of moving parts, especially with people. So you have to be good with people, and that's something that I worked really hard at trying to do, is making sure you have good communication. And I would say those are the two biggest, you know, difficulties, is making sure you're good with communication and you have a way of funding what you want to make.
Yeah, I mean, as a director, it probably takes a lot of communication. You're telling people, hey, you know, this is the vision, and stuff like that. And I'm assuming communication would probably be the biggest thing, if not the only thing that matters.
Yeah, it's extremely important, and being very clear with the people that you're that are part of your team. If you're not clear, then you're setting up your project to fail. So I've learned that.
Are you looking for support to finish this film?
Oh yeah, absolutely I am. I'm currently have a open a crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo for this project. And I'm happy to provide a link to that. I don't think I could spell out a URL over the over the radio, but on Indiegogo, if you look up The Tall Gentleman, or we have our campaign there that's currently live, and we're actively looking for contributors to the project.
When it's finished, when would it be released?
So the original plan was for the project to be released on October 25th, in the heart of the Halloween season. Considering some aspects of, you know, kind of the production of this film, hopefully we're able to meet that. I've been pushing hard to try to get kind of boots on the ground and a solid, you know, filming dates and everything and working with the actors. But that was the hope. There is a chance that might have to be put, that date may have to be pushed back, but as of right now, it's October 25th is what we're working towards.
And is there a place that people can go to find out more or watch it when it's released?
Oh, absolutely. Eventually, I will post the film onto my YouTube channel, Fedora Films, on YouTube, obviously. And the project, although, will also be... I will be submitting it to several film festivals here on the West Coast, including Screamfest down in Los Angeles, the Seattle Horror Film Festival, and the Portland Film Festival here, as well as a few other film festivals around the West Coast.
Excellent. Well, thank you for so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure interviewing you.
I'm really honored for the opportunity I had to come in here and to share more about this project with you guys. This project means a lot to me. I've been a huge fan of the Slender Man mythos and the character for since at least 2010, 2011, and since the almost the very beginnings of the character. And I really wanted to have the opportunity to kind of create a project that really was an homage to the fandom of this, you know, really iconic character. And as you've noted to me previously, you know, you thought about how Slender Man has kind of not gotten a good rap since he came on the scene, and he kind of had his heyday. But, you know, as far as on the big screen, he didn't really have a lot of people would agree that he didn't really have a really good go. And so I wanted to make just a short and sweet project that really paid homage to the great myth, and so hopefully that this project, The Tall Gentleman, is able to do that.
For the KBOO EP.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.